This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Infernal Devices, Book 3, Clockwork Princess by Cassandra Clare. Read by Daniel Sharman.
Chapter 13. The Mind Has Mountains. Oh, the mind. Mind has mountains. Cliffs of fall frightful, sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap, May, who near hung there. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. All life, death, does end, and each day dies with sleep. Gerard Manley Hopkins. No worst. There is none. Tessa could never remember later if she had screamed as she had fallen. She remembered only a long and silent fall, the river and the rocks hurtling toward her, the sky at her feet. The wind tore at her face and hair as she twisted in the air, and she felt a sharp jerk at her throat. Her hands flew up. Her angel necklace was lifting over her head, as if an enormous hand had reached down out of the sky to remove it. A metallic blur surrounded her, a pair of great wings opening like gates, and something caught at her, arresting her fall. Her eyes widened. It was impossible, unimaginable. But her angel, her clockwork angel, had grown somehow to the size of a living human being, and was hovering over her, its great mechanical wings beating against the wind. She stared up into a blank, beautiful face, the face of a statue made of metal, as expressionless as ever. But the angel had hands as articulate as her own, and they were holding her up as the wings beat and beat and beat, and she fell slowly now, gently, like a puff of dandelion fluff blown on the wind. Maybe I am dying, Tessa thought, and this cannot be. But as the angel held her and they drifted together toward the earth, the ground came clearer and clearer into focus. She could see the individual rocks by the side of the stream now, the currents as they ran downstream, the reflection of the sun in the water. The shadow of wings appeared against the earth and grew wider and wider until she was falling into it, falling into the shadow, and she and the angel plunged together to the ground and landed in the soft dirt and scattered rocks at the side of the stream. Tessa gasped as she landed, more from shock than impact, and reached up, as if she could cushion the angel's fall with her body. But it was shrinking already, growing smaller and smaller, its wings folding in on themselves, until it struck the ground by her side, the size of a toy once more. She reached out a shaking hand and seized it. She was lying on uneven rocks, half in, half out of the chilly water. It was already soaking through her skirts. She seized the pendant and crawled up the side of the stream with the remainder of her strength, and collapsed at last on dry ground with the angel pressed against her chest, ticking its familiar beat against her heart. Sophie sat in the armchair by the side of Jem's bed that had always been Will's place, and watched Jem sleep. There had been a time, she thought, when she would have been most grateful for this opportunity, a chance to be so close to him, to place cold cloths against his forehead when he stirred and murmured and burned with fever. And though she no longer loved him as she once had, the way, she realized now, one loves someone one did not know at all, with admiration and distance, it still wrung her heart to see him like this. One of the girls in the town where Sophie had grown up had died of consumption, and Sophie recalled how they had all talked of the way the disease had made her more beautiful before it killed her, made her pale and slender, and flushed her face with a hectic, rosy glow. Jem had that fever in his cheeks now as he tossed against his pillows. His silvery white hair was like frost, and his restless fingers twitched against the blanket. Every once in a while he spoke, but the words were in Mandarin, and she did not know them. He called out for Tessa.
Why ni Tessa? Bululang. Hua qing wu sashung. Hua min do hui tai chi.
And he called out for Will as well.
Sung su ji jiao.
in a way that made Sophie want to take his hand and hold it, though when she did reach out to touch him, he was burning up with fever and snatched his hand away with a cry. Sophie shrank back against the chair, wondering if she should call for Charlotte. Charlotte would want to know if Jem's condition worsened. She was about to rise to her feet when suddenly Jem gasped and his eyes flew open. She sank back into the chair, staring. His irises were such a pale silver that they were nearly white.
"Will," he said. "Will, is that you?"
"No," she said, almost afraid to move.
"It's Sophie."
He exhaled softly and turned his head toward her on the pillow. She saw him focus on her face with an effort, and then, incredibly, he smiled. That smile of great sweetness that had first won her heart.
"Of course," he said. "Sophie, Will is not... I sent Will away."
"He has gone after Tessa," Sophie said.
"Good."
Jem's long hands plucked at the blanket, contracted once into fists, and then relaxed.
"I am glad." "You miss him," Sophie said.
Jem nodded slowly.
"I can feel it. His distance, like a cord inside me, pulled very, very tightly. I did not expect that. We have not been apart since we became parapetai."
"Cecily said you sent him away."
"Yes," said Jem. "He was difficult to persuade. I think if he were not in love with Tessa himself, I would not have been able to make him go."
Sophie's mouth fell open.
"You knew?" "Not for long," Jem said. "No. I would not be that cruel. If I had known, I would never have proposed. I would have stood back. I did not know. And yet now, as everything is going away from me, all things appear in such a clear light that I think I would have come to know it, even if he had not told me. At the end of things, I would have known."
He smiled a little at Sophie's stricken expression.
"I'm glad I did not have to wait until the end."
"You're not angry?"
"I'm glad," he said. "They will be able to take care of each other when I'm gone, or at least I can hope for it. He says she does not love him, but surely she will come to love him in time. Will is easy to love, and he has given her his whole heart. I can see it. I hope she will not break it." Sophie could not think of a word to say. She did not know what anyone could say in the face of love like this. So much forbearance, so much endurance, so much hope. There had been many times in the past months when she'd regretted that she'd ever had a bad thought about Will Herondale. When she saw how he had stood back and allowed Tessa and Jem to be happy together, and she knew the agony that had come to Tessa along with the happiness in the knowledge that she was hurting Will. Sophie alone, she thought, knew that Tessa called out for Will sometimes when she slept. She alone knew that the scar on Tessa's palm was not from an accidental encounter with a fireplace poker, but a deliberate wound, inflicted on herself that she might, somehow, physically match the emotional pain she'd felt in denying Will. Sophie had held Tessa while she'd wept and torn the flowers out of her hair that were the color of Will's eyes, and Sophie had covered up with powder the evidence of tears and sleepless nights. Should she tell him? Sophie wondered. Would it really be a kindness to say, "Yes, Tessa loves him too. She has tried not to, but she does"? Could any man honestly want to hear that about the girl he was going to marry? "Miss Grey has a great regard for Mr. Herondale, and she would not break any heart lightly, I think," Sophie said. "But I wish you would not speak as if your death were inevitable, Mr. Carstairs. Even now, Mrs. Bramwell and the others are hopeful of finding a cure. I think you will live to an old age with Miss Grey, and the both of you very happy."
He smiled as if he knew something she did not.
"That is kind of you to say, Sophie.
I know I am a shadow hunter, and we do not pass easily from this life. We fight to the last. We come from the realm of angels, and yet we fear it. I think, though, that one can face the end and not be afraid, without having bowed under to death. Death shall never rule me." Sophie looked at him, a little worried. He sounded part delirious to her.
"Mr. Carstairs, shall I fetch Charlotte?" "In a moment. But Sophie, in your expression just there when I spoke," he leaned forward. "Is it true then?"
"Is what true?" she asked him in a small voice, but she knew what the question would be, and she could not lie to Jem. Will was in a foul mood. The day had dawned foggy, wet, and dreadful. He had woken feeling sick to his stomach, and had only barely been able to choke down the rubbery eggs and cold bacon the landlord's wife had served him in the stuffy parlour. Every part of his body had hummed to get back to the road and continue on his journey. Bouts of rain had left him shivering in his clothes, despite a liberal use of warming runes, and Balios disliked the mud that sucked at his hooves as they tried to make speed along the road, Will grumpily contemplating how it was possible that fog might actually condense upon the inside of one's clothes. He had at least made it to Northamptonshire, which was something, but he had covered barely 20 miles and flatly refused to stop, though Balios looked at him entreatingly as they passed through Towcester, as if begging for a warm room in a stable and some oats, and Will was almost inclined to give it to him. A sense of hopelessness had invaded his bones, as chill and inescapable as the rain. What did he think he was doing? Did he really think he would find Tessa this way? Was he a fool? They were passing through disagreeable country now, too, where the mud made the rocky pathway treacherous. A great cliff wall rose on one side of the road, blocking out the sky. On the other side of the path, the road fell away dramatically into a ravine full of sharp rocks. The distant water of a muddy stream glinted faintly at the ravine's bottom. Will kept Balios's head well pulled in, far from the drop-off, but the horse still seemed skittish and shy of the fall. Will's own head was down, tucked into his collar to avoid the cold rain. It was only by chance that, glancing for a moment to the side, he caught a glimpse of bright green and gold amid the rocks at the edge of the road. He had pulled up Balios in an instant, and was down off the horse so quickly that he almost slipped in the mud. The rain was coming down more heavily now as he approached and knelt to examine the golden chain that had become caught around the sharp outcrop of a rock. He picked it up carefully. It was a jade pendant, circular, with characters stamped on the back. He knew well enough what they meant. When two people are as one in their innermost hearts, they shatter even the strength of iron or bronze. Jem's bridal gift to Tessa. Will's hand tightened about it as he stood. He remembered facing her in the stairwell, the chain of the jade pendant at her throat winking at him like a cruel reminder of Jem. As she'd said, "They say you cannot divide your heart, and yet..." "Tessa!" he cried out suddenly, his voice echoing off the rocks. "Tessa, Tessa, Tessa." He stood for a moment, shuddering at the side of the road. He did not know what he had expected. An answer? It was hardly as if she could be here, hiding among the sparse rocks. There was only silence and the sound of the wind and rain. Still, he knew without a shadow of a doubt that this was Tessa's necklace. Perhaps she had torn it from her throat and dropped it out of the carriage window to mark the path for him, like Hansel and Gretel's trail of breadcrumbs. It was what a storybook heroine would do, and therefore what his Tessa would do. Maybe there would be other markers too if he kept on his way. For the first time, hope flowed back into his veins. With new resolve, he strode toward Balios and swung himself up into the saddle. There would be no slowing down. They would make Staffordshire by evening. As he turned the horse's head back toward the road, he slipped the pendant into his pocket, where its engraved words of love and commitment seemed to burn like a brand. Charlotte had never felt so tired. The coming child had exhausted her more than she thought it would at first, and she had been awake all night and racing about all day. There were stains on her dress from Henry's crypt, and her ankles ached from going up and down the stairs and the ladders in the library. Nevertheless, when she opened the door of Jem's bedroom and saw him not only awake but sitting up and talking to Sophie, she forgot her tiredness and felt her face break into a helpless smile of relief. "James," she exclaimed, "I had wondered. That is, I am glad you are awake." Sophie, who was looking oddly flushed, rose to her feet. "Should I go, Mrs. Branwell?" "Oh, yes, please, Sophie. Bridget is in one of her moods. She says she can't find the bang, Mary, and I haven't even the slightest what she's talking about." Sophie almost smiled. She would have if her heart hadn't been pounding with the knowledge that she might just have done something very dreadful. "The Ben Marie," she said. "I will locate it for her." She moved toward the door, paused, and threw a peculiar look over her shoulder at Jem, who was resting back against his pillows, looking very pale but composed. Before Charlotte could say anything, Sophie was gone, and Jem was beckoning Charlotte forward with a tired smile.
"Charlotte, if you would not mind very much, could you bring me my violin?"
"Of course."
Charlotte went over to the table by the window where the violin was stored in its square rosewood case, with its bow and small round box of rosin. She lifted the violin and brought it over to the bed, where Jem took it carefully from her arms, and she sank down gratefully in the chair beside him.
"Oh," she said a moment later, "I'm sorry. I forgot the bow. Did you want to play?"
"That's all right."
He plucked gently at the strings with his fingertips, which produced a soft, vibrant noise.
"This is pizzicato, the first thing my father taught me how to do when he showed me the violin. It reminds me of being a child."
"You are still a child,"
Charlotte wanted to say, but she did not. He was only a few weeks short of his 18th birthday, after all, when shadow hunters became adults, and if when she looked at him she still saw the dark-haired little boy who had arrived from Shanghai clutching his violin, his huge eyes and his pale face, that did not mean he had not grown up. She reached for the box of Yin Fen on his bedside table. There was only a pale scatter left at the bottom, barely a teaspoonful. She swallowed against her tight throat and tapped the powder into the bottom of a glass, then poured water from the carafe into it, letting the Yin Fen dissolve like sugar. When she handed it to Jem, he put the violin aside and took the glass from her. He stared down into it, his pale eyes thoughtful.
"Is this the last of it?" he asked.
"Magnus is working on a cure," Charlotte said. "We all are. Gabriel and Cecily are out purchasing ingredients for medicine to keep you strong, and Sophie and Gideon and I have been researching. Everything is being done. Everything."
Jem looked a little surprised.
"I did not realize."
"But of course it is," Charlotte said. "We are your family. We would do anything for you. Please do not lose hope, Jem. I need you to keep your strength."
"What strength I have is yours," he said cryptically.
He downed the Yin Fen solution, handing her back the empty glass.
"Charlotte."
"Yes?"
"Have you won the fight about what to call the child yet?"
Charlotte gave a startled laugh. It seemed odd to think about her child now, but then why not? In death, we are in life. It was something to think about that was not illness, or Tessa's disappearance, or Will's dangerous mission.
"Not yet," she said. "Henry is still insisting on Buford."
"You'll win," Jem said. "You always do. You would make an excellent consul, Charlotte."
Charlotte wrinkled her nose. "A woman consul? After all the trouble I've had for simply running the Institute?"
"There must always be a first," said Jem. "It is not easy to be first, and it is not always rewarding, but it is important." He ducked his head. "You carry with you one of my few regrets."
Charlotte looked at him puzzled.
"I would have liked to see the baby."
It was a very simple, wistful thing to say, but it lodged itself in Charlotte's heart like a sliver of glass. She began to cry, the tears slipping silently down her face.
"Charlotte," Jem said, as if comforting her, "you've always taken care of me. You'll take amazing care of this baby. You'll be a wonderful mother."
"You cannot give up, Jem," she said in a choked voice. "When they brought you to me, at first they said you would live only a year or two. You've lived nearly six. Please just live a few more days. A few more days for me."
Jem gave her a softly measured look.
"I lived for you," he said, "and I lived for Will. And then I lived for Tessa, and for myself, because I wanted to be with her. But I cannot live for other people forever. No one can say that death found in me a willing comrade, or that I went easily. If you say you need me, I will stay as long as I can for you. I will live for you and yours, and go down fighting death until I am worn away to bone and splinters. But it would not be my choice."
"Then," Charlotte looked at him hesitantly, "what would be your choice?"
He swallowed and his hand dropped to touch the violin by his side.
"I made the decision," he said. "I made it when I told Will to go."
He ducked his head and then looked up at Charlotte, his pale, blue-shadowed eyes fixed on her face as if willing her to understand.
I wanted to stop, he said. Sophie says everyone is still searching for a cure for me. I know I gave Will my permission, but I want everyone to cease looking now. Charlotte, it is over.
It was growing dark by the time Cecily and Gabriel returned to the Institute. To be out and about in the city with someone besides Charlotte or her brother had been a unique experience for Cecily, and she was astonished at what good company Gabriel Lightwood had been. He had made her laugh, though she had done her best to hide it, and he had quite obligingly carried all the parcels, though she would have expected him to protest at being treated like a harried footman. It was true that he probably should not have thrown the fairy through the shop window, or into the Limehouse Canal afterwards. But she could hardly blame him. She knew perfectly well that it was not the fact that the satyr had shown her improper images that had snapped his temper, but the reminder of his father. It was odd, she thought, as they mounted the Institute steps, how unlike his brother he was. She had liked Gideon perfectly well since she had arrived in London, but found him quiet and contained. He did not speak much, and though he sometimes helped Will with her training, he was distant and thoughtful with everyone but Sophie. With her, it was possible to see flashes of humour in him. He could be quite dryly funny when he wished to be, and had a darkly observant nature alongside his calm soul. In bits and pieces gleaned from Tessa, Will and Charlotte, Cecily had pieced together the story of the Lightwoods, and had begun to understand why Gideon was so quiet. In a way, like Will and herself, he had turned his back on his family deliberately, and he carried the scars of that loss. Gabriel's choice had been a different one. He had stayed by his father's side and watched the slow deterioration of his body and mind. What had he thought while it was happening? At what point did he realize the choice he had made had been the wrong one? Gabriel opened the Institute door and Cecily went through. They were greeted by Bridget's voice, floating down the steps.
O, see ye not yon narrow road, so thick beset with thorns and briars? That is the path of righteousness, though after it but few inquires. And see not ye the broad, broad road that lies across the lily levin? That is the path of wickedness, though some call it the road to heaven.
She's singing, said Cecily, starting up the steps. Again.
Gabriel, balancing the parcels nimbly, made an equable noise.
I'm famished. I wonder if she'll scare me up some cold chicken and bread in the kitchen if I tell her I don't mind the songs.
Everyone minds the songs. Cecily looked at him sideways. He had an awfully fine profile. Gideon was good-looking as well, but Gabriel was all sharp angles, chin and cheekbones, which she thought altogether more elegant.
"'Tisn't your fault, you know,' she said abruptly.
"'What is not my fault?'
They turned from the steps under the corridor of the second floor. It seemed dark to Cecily, the witch lights turned down low. She could hear Bridget still singing. It was dark, dark night. There was no starlight. And they waded through red blood to the knee. For all the blood that's shed on earth runs through the springs of that country.
Your father, Cecily said.
Gabriel's face tightened. For a moment Cecily thought he was going to make an angry retort, but instead he said only,
It may or may not be my fault, but I chose to be blind to his crimes. I believed in him when it was wrong to do so, and he has disgraced the name of Lightwood.
Cecily was silent for a moment.
I came here because I believed shadow hunters were monsters who had taken my brother. I believed it because my parents believed it. But they were wrong. We are not our parents, Gabriel. We do not have to carry the burden of their choices or their sins. You can make the Lightwood name shine again.
That is the difference between you and me, he said, with not a little bitterness. You chose to come here. I was driven out of my home, chased here by the monster that was once my father.
Well, Cecily said kindly. Not chased all the way here. Only as far as Chiswick, I thought.
What? She smiled at him.
I am Will Herondale's sister. You can't expect me to be serious all the time.
His expression at that was so comical that she giggled. She was still giggling when they pushed the library door open and entered, and both stopped dead in their tracks. Charlotte, Henry, and Gideon were sitting around one of the long tables. Magnus stood a distance away by the window, his hands clasped behind him. His back was rigid and straight. Henry looked wan and tired, Charlotte tear-stained. Gideon's face was a mask. The laughter died on Cecily's lips.
What is it?
Has there been word? Is Will...
It is not Will, said Charlotte. It is Jem.
Cecily bit her lip, even as her heartbeat slowed with guilty relief. She had thought first of her brother, but of course it was his parabatai who was in more imminent peril.
Jem, she breathed.
He is still alive, Henry said in answer to her unspoken question.
Well then, we got everything, Gabriel said, putting the parcels down on the table. Everything Magnus asked for, the Damiana, the Bad's Head root.
Thank you, Magnus spoke from the window without turning.
Yes, thank you, Charlotte said. You did all I asked, and I am grateful. But I'm afraid your errand was in vain. She looked down at the parcel, and then back up again. It was clear that it was taking her a great effort to speak. Jem has made a decision, she said. He wishes us to cease searching for a cure. He has had the last of the Yinfen. There is no more, and it is a matter of hours now. I've summoned the Silent Brothers. It is time to say goodbye.
It was dark in the training room. The shadows lay long upon the floor, and moonlight came in through the high-arched windows. Cecily sat on one of the worn benches and stared down at the patterns the moonlight made on the splintered wooden floor. Her right hand idly worried at the red pendant around her throat. She could not help but think of her brother. Part of her mind was there in the Institute, but the rest was with Will, on the back of a horse, leaning into the wind, riding hell for leather over the roads that separated London from Dogothai. She wondered if she was frightened. She wondered if she would see him again. So deep in thought was she that she started at the creak of the door as it opened. A long shadow was cast across the floor, and she looked up to see Gabriel Lightwood blinking at her in surprise.
Hiding here, are you?
He said.
That's awkward.
Why? She was surprised at how ordinary her voice sounded, even calm.
Because I intended to hide here myself.
Cecily was silent for a moment. Gabriel actually looked a little uncertain. It hung strangely on him. He was usually so confident. Though it was a more fragile confidence than his brother's, it was too dark for her to see the color of his eyes or hair, and for the first time she could actually see the resemblance between him and Gideon. They had the same determined set to their chins, the same wide-spaced eyes and careful stance.
You may hide here with me, she said, if you wish.
He nodded and crossed the room to where she sat, but instead of joining her, he moved to the window and glanced outside.
The Silent Brothers' carriage is here, he said.
Yes, said Cecily. She knew from her reading of the Codex that the Silent Brothers were both the doctors and the priests of the Shadowhunter world. One might expect to find them at deathbeds and sickbeds and childbed alike.
I thought I should see Jem, for Will, but I could not bring myself. I am a coward, she added as an afterthought. It was not something she had ever thought about herself before.
Then I am too, he replied.
The moonlight fell across one side of his face, making him look as if he were wearing a half-mask.
I had come up here to be alone, and, frankly, to be away from the brothers, for they give me the chills. I thought I might play solitaire. We could, if you like, have a game of beggar my neighbour.
Like Pip and Estella in Great Expectations, said Cecily, with a flash of amusement.
But no, I do not know how to play cards.
My mother tried to keep cards out of the house as my father had a weakness for them.
She looked up at Gabriel.
You know, in some ways we are the same. Our brothers left and we were alone without brother or sister, with a father who was deteriorating. Mine went a bit mad for a while after Will left and Ella died. It took him years to recover himself. In the meantime we lost our home, just as you lost Chiswick.
Chiswick was taken from us, said Gabriel, with an acidic flash of bitterness.
And to be quite honest, I'm both sorry and not. My memories of the place, he shuddered. My father locked himself in the study a fortnight before I came here for help. I should have come earlier, but I was too proud. I did not want to admit that I'd been wrong about father. For that 2 weeks I barely slept. I banged on the door of the study and begged my father to come out, to speak to me, but I heard only inhuman noises. I turned the lock on my door at night, and in the morning, there would be blood on the stairs.
I told myself the servants had fled. I knew better. So no, we are not the same, Cecily, because you left. You were brave. I stayed until there was no choice but to leave. I stayed even though I knew it was wrong. You are a Lightwood, Cecily said. You stay because you are loyal to your family name. It is not cowardice. Wasn't it? Is loyalty still a commendable quality when it is misdirected? Cecily opened her mouth and then closed it again. Gabriel was looking at her, his eyes shining in the moonlight. He seemed genuinely desperate to hear her answer. She wondered if he had anyone else to talk to. She could see how it might be terrifying to take one's moral qualms to Gideon. He seemed so staunch, as if he had never questioned himself in his life and would not understand those who did. I think, she said, choosing her words with care, that any good impulse can be twisted into something evil. Look at the Magister. He does what he does because he hates the Shadow Hunters, out of loyalty to his parents, who cared for him and who were killed. It is not beyond the realm of understanding, and yet nothing excuses the result. I think, when we make choices, for each choice is individual of the choices we have made before, we must examine not only our reasons for making them, but what result they will have, and whether good people will be hurt by our decisions. There was a pause. Then, you are very wise, Cecily Herondale, he said. Do not regret too much the choices you have made in the past, Gabriel, she said, aware that she was using his Christian name, but not able to help it. Only make the right ones in future. We are ever capable of change and ever capable of being our better selves. That, said Gabriel, would not be the self my father wanted me to be, and despite everything, I find myself reluctant to dismiss the hope of his approval. Cecily sighed. We can do our best, Gabriel. I tried to be the child my parents wanted, the lady they wished me to be. I left to bring Will back to them because I thought it was the right thing to do. I knew they were grieved when he had chosen a different path, and it is the right one for him, for all that he came to it strangely. It is his path. Do not choose the path your father would have chosen or the path your brother would choose. Be the Shadow Hunter you want to be. He sounded very young when he replied, How do I know that I will make the right choice? Outside the window, horses' hooves sounded on the flagstones of the courtyard. The Silent Brothers, leaving. Jem, Cecily thought, with a pang in her heart. Her brother had always looked to him as a kind of North Star, a compass that would ever point him toward the right decision. She had never quite thought of her brother as lucky before, and certainly would not expect to do so today. And yet in a way he had been. To always have someone to turn to like that, and not to worry constantly that one was looking to the wrong stars. She tried to make her voice as firm and as strong as it could be for herself as much as for the boy at the window. Perhaps, Gabriel Lightwood, I have faith in you.